Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Into the middle! Liverpool win it with a golden goal! It's 5-4.
Pepe Reina is the hero! Liverpool have won the FA Cup for the seventh time! They won the first final here in Cardiff in 2001, and they've won what may be the last final in Cardiff in 2006.
There will be no second chances if Shevchenko misses.
He saved it!
Welcome to the Book Club on Football Ramble Presents. I'm Kate Mason.
I'm Jim Campbell.
And today we're with a Champions League winner with 10 other major trophies to his name. A Liverpool legend who played over 700 games for his club, the second most of any player in the club's history. And one club man and an England international. And if it was just his playing career he had to tell us about, it'd be worth having a chat with this one. But after retirement, the versatile defender developed a new talent, that of communicating football to us.
When I press play now, this is 15 seconds into the game. This is right from the kickoff. The ball now comes across, Mo Salah tries to press, and this is what I talk about is positional play. Normally then you'd look and think, you stop it there, and I think, where's the right back?
As a pundit, Jamie Carragher professionalised football analysis, bringing in a new era of football understanding through Sky's Monday Night Football and setting the pace for the more demanding modern football fan. His book, The Greatest Games, builds on this version of his work. He speaks with some of the greatest names in football to support his tactical analysis of important games in a book that at times reads like a university text on modern football, in the best possible way. And we're delighted to have Jamie Carragher in the Ramble studio today to talk to us about his book, The Greatest Games. Jamie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. I didn't want you to stop then. No, thanks for having me.
Oh, no, it's great. We can't wait to hear talk about this. And we were thinking, reading through, we know obviously you did an autobiography, what, over 10 years ago now. But we thought it was really interesting that you chose to do this. So it's like an analysis of 11 key games that you've really enjoyed in your career and also just within football. Why was this the book that you wanted to write now?
Well, as you said, I've done my autobiography. I regret doing it at the time I did. I wish I'd have waited to the end of my career to obviously speak about the last few years and how that went. But I don't think an autobiography is something I will revisit anytime soon. So I've always been fascinated by football books, read a lot of them over the years. Michael Cox had a couple of books out that I really enjoyed. I'm reading a Barcelona book now by Simon Cooper that I'm halfway through. I've got an Arrigo Sacchi book on the immortals of the late 80s, AC Milan. That will be next. So I've always been not so much fascinated by them, but you know, enjoyed reading them and thought if I did another book, I'd love to do a football book. And there was one book that was called The Italian Job with, I think, Marcotti and Gianluca Vialli did. Gabriel Marcotti and Gianluca Vialli and speaking about the differences between Italian football and English football. So I always wanted to be involved in a football book like that where I could talk about, as I have done in this, tactics, games, whatever it may be, and it rather than it being just about myself.
Good idea. I mean, it's quite a refreshing thing to hear when we're talking about these kind of books. And it was during lockdown as well, so I guess people couldn't run from you if you wanted to talk to them.
Yes, it was perfect timing in some ways in that we were going through it and trying to get hold of people. There was no way anyone could tell me they couldn't answer a phone or an email because obviously we were all stuck in the house. And I got through a lot of the interviews through that time. So the thread of the book is we've got 11 games, different games. So you're trying to get the viewpoint of two or three players from each team within that book, really. So and because a lot of these games are 20, 30 years old, you're speaking to sort of former legends or even heroes of mine. The Everton team growing up, the Liverpool team of the late 80s, trying to get some foreign players involved. I mean, I spoke to Hernan Crespo, which is really interesting on obviously the Istanbul game. But it's always nice, I think, to get the other view. Sometimes you have your own thoughts of how a game's went, but it's nice to get different points of view on the different games from both sides of the camp.
It's interesting how I think most people probably never watch a game back, realistically. Fans, certainly, I imagine players, you analyse your own performances, but I'm sure not even all players do that. But so there's a sense that like a lot of these games surprise you, actually, in that the narrative is very, very, that has gone around the game is very, very different from what happened. That seems like pretty much every game, there is some element of that. So it's interesting to get that insight into it. And it's also really, really interesting to get, like, I feel like I understand football a bit better having read this book and seen sort of how much goes into each phase of play almost. And I'm really interested in how that happens on the pitch. Like, are you reading the game like that when you play? Are all these different things going through your head? Because football looks like chaos when you watch it on TV, but obviously we know it isn't, especially at the top level. So is this an accurate depiction of what it's like to play in a game as well? Are you thinking that quickly? Is that what it's like at the top level?
I mean, I that was my greatest strength on a football pitch in terms of my understanding of the game, because I didn't have anything that stood out that was outstanding, I would say. You know, someone might be lightning quick or a great passer of the ball or score goals, whatever it could be. I don't think I ever stand out something where I say Jamie Carragher was amazing at this. That wasn't me as a footballer. I was okay at most things. But what made me the player I was what was between my ears, basically, in terms of reading the game, understanding the game, also being very focused, very aggressive. You know, every game was a cup final for me. So that's why I think I can do this book. This is why I can do punditry at the moment on maybe Monday Night Football. But it's very difficult as a player to change a complete game when it's going on. You can realise what's going on. But it's very difficult for me to then stop Steven Gerrard doing what he's doing. You can speak and talk and organise, or you might think, we're not playing well today. It's not quite happening. You're trying, obviously, improve the performance by organisation, but it might be a case where, okay, if we're not doing this, we need to do this. And that was my sort of role, certainly under Rafa Benitez with Liverpool, where I was centre-back, so I was almost in charge of the back four and people in front of me and organisation. So it might be a case of, we need to drop off 10 yards, we need to push up, or we need to slow the game down, or these type of things, what I'm talking about in a book, when you get tactical, really. But it's difficult when there's 22 players on a pitch and you almost have to go with the flow. But how can you make the best version of this, of, you know, the way the game's going?
You talk about Rafa Benitez in a very positive light, of course. And you said he's the university professor who made me the player that I was. And he presented you with a particular DVD, didn't he? Do you remember about this, of the AC Milan back line? Was that a common thing to do? Was that, how did that inspire you?
No, I don't think it was a common thing. I don't think it was, you know, there's DVDs given out to the rest of the squad. But I think a guy I spoke to a couple of weeks ago, Rigo Sacchi, I went to speak to him. He's like
just a guy.
Yeah.
Just a guy I was hanging out with a few weeks ago.
in his home. He looked after us. And we were speaking about his new book that's coming out, The Immortals. And he is almost like a reference point for so many coaches. Rafa Benitez being one, Jurgen Klopp as well. He actually mentioned that Thomas Tuchel had been out to see him a couple of weeks ago. So he's almost like this guy everyone needs to speak to about the way that the modern game is played. And of that, you know, being really compact as a team from back to front, pushing up. They obviously, the offside rules were different then. But if you actually watch Liverpool now, how high they get up the pitch, it is like watching Baresi pushing up that AC Milan back four, that famous back four. So that's what it was about. This is what we're trying to do. This is Rafa Benitez saying, we're trying to do this. So when we're on the training pitch, this is where we want to get to. Now, Jamie Carragher will never get to Franco Baresi. I don't think anyone ever will. And the fact there's a cup across.
Yeah, Franco Baresi mug in the studio
number
now.
Number six, I absolutely adore that man. And but that was what we were trying to get to. And I think a lot of teams see that team. I think Pep's Barcelona team. I think the Dutch team of the 70s. And this is what Rigo Sacchi was talking about. Those were the three teams that almost changed football and set in place a philosophy every sort of 20, 25 years where the game moves on a little bit. And I think that's what those DVDs were about. This is utopia. This is where we're trying to get to, basically.
So when you say, sorry, to just clarify, Jim, I know you wanted to comment. You're saying Rafa Benitez did that for you specifically, but he might not have done it because he saw you with that kind of mind, or you were that kind of player who would react well to that kind of process.
Yeah, I think he knew that I loved football, understood football. So I could understand what Rafa was asking the team to do, and certain players. Now, certain players don't understand it, but they have different qualities. And that's what I was trying to explain before. I didn't have an outstanding technical or physical quality.
Apparently modesty is like one of them, but yeah, okay. Yeah,
but I had a good understanding of the game. I watched a lot of football. I mean, some of the players you would not believe, they probably wouldn't know that AC Milan team or know who Baresi was. That's just the way football is. But I was obviously well aware, could understand, right, that's a trigger point. We need to push out when this happens, or we need to drop off when this happens. So that was just part of my education. Mm. And then he knew when I went onto the pitch in that situation, I could organise people to push up, to drop off, to do whatever he felt was needed.
That's really interesting to me, because I guess that answers my earlier question, which is that, you know, do players think in this much depth in the pit on the pitch? And I guess it's like some of you do, and then you take care of the rest almost. So you're organising on the pitch and making sure the team just functions.
Yeah, I think that was my role under Rafa, certainly, because I was in the centre of defence. I wasn't on the level of other centre-backs in England in terms of John Terry, Rio Ferdinand, shall we say. Just looking at them physically, you know, probably 3 or 4 inches taller than me, quicker than me, more powerful. So I had to sort of be someone who tried to play with the brain, if you like, in terms of organisation. Doesn't always work, there's no doubt. But yeah, Rafa Benitez was very much about the details of, you know, tactically, really, how you stop the opposition, how you can, what are their weaknesses that we can exploit, and not every player would understand what was needed. They just go out and play their own game. Mm. So you need certain players who have different qualities on the pitch.
Because you spend all this time thinking about the game, and as you've pointed out, in a way that quite often players don't. I don't know how it makes you feel sometimes when, I suppose, there's different players in the game, right? But sometimes guys will be like, oh no, I've never heard of Jamie Carragher or whatever. You know, some of these guys, they haven't even watched stuff from a few years back, let alone. But is that why I think you found it fairly difficult to finish playing and then make that transition? Did this offer you some kind of solace within that, doing punditry, I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I always felt I would be a coach. I always felt I'd be involved in football. I love football. I think about it, you know, 24/7, watch a lot of games. And yeah, I always knew I'd be involved in the game. And I think everyone in the dressing room felt I would be a coach or a manager. You know, Stevie's gone on to do that now really well at Rangers. But I think even if you'd ask Stevie, he would say I'm a lot more obsessed with football than he is. And could speak about an AC Milan team maybe more than he could, or past football or players or systems or managers. And just because you like that doesn't necessarily mean you should be a coach or a manager. You know, there's a lot of different things that go into, you know, that role, coaching and managing. But the later I got into my career, the more I liked the idea of punditry. And I'll be honest with you, I used to watch shows when I was a player and just think it was average, you know, in terms of what people were talking about or how deep they were going.
And the great thing about what you did actually was what I was trying to get across at the top is that by doing it so much better, it improved everything else as well. Because like, I think Match of the Day wouldn't be the way it is now if it hadn't been for what you guys were doing.
Well, listen, thank you. I don't know what to say to that. Thank you. I'm not sure Gary Lineker will be too happy when he listens.
But
that's not to say I'm better than anyone else. I mean, I watch other shows to see what they're doing now and say, well, can we do better than that? Well, I don't agree with that. Or that was really good. Could we spin that? Or could we do something different? So I've always watched all the other TV shows. But listen, it's like anything in life. Things move on, they get better. Most things, I would say, get better with more detail. I think fans now, even what yous are doing, the Football Ramble, talking about football. I think with social media now, I think the analysis of football in terms of fans talking about their own clubs and going really deep and looking at systems. And I think the level of analysis now is on a completely different level to where it was when I was playing. And, you know, it was probably just Match of the Day, a little bit of Monday Night Football with Andy Gray at the time, which I really enjoyed. And, we've tried to push it on. But listen, I'm sure in 10 years' time or 20 years' time, someone else will have pushed it on and, like, you know, it keeps going. Hopefully that's me.
So with that in mind, you've got the whole of football to look over, eventually, to talk about your favourite, you know, your favourite games within it. How did you get down to the 11? Was there anything that just missed out, or was it a fairly easy process?
It was basically, I wanted to do games that when I didn't want to go further back than sort of when I you know.
It's your living memory, isn't it?
Yeah. So what was the first football team I can remember as a kid? Everton, 84-85. Winning the league, winning the European Cup, winners' cup, getting to the FA Cup final. That's my first season as a fan. Everton's most famous game is Bayern Munich at home. So you do that, and almost watching the 90 minutes, because a narrative comes out of games. And that's a big thing for me in punditry, that sometimes this message comes out from a game, but when you watch it back, it's not true. Mm. It doesn't happen. So that's the things that sort of get me going in punditry. Like, for instance, I did Monday Night Football on Monday, obviously, and there was this sort of narrative coming out after Man United played Spurs that they played counter-attack and they can't press high with Cristiano Ronaldo. And I watched the game back and it just didn't happen. Mm. They pressed high. So I did that analysis, and maybe you're going against the grain. And that's sometimes when you watch the games back in the book, when people talk about these games with rose-tinted spectacles, it's not the same. So that's what I was trying to almost do within these games. And also, don't forget, these games didn't have the analysis of what we've got now. And that's what I was trying to put on. So it was a case of those type of games. I didn't want it to come across as a Liverpool book, but I think most people go, Jamie Carragher, the greatest games, this will just be Liverpool games. So we put different sort of titles on the front of the
It is
the
quite
games.
Red, the cover, I would say.
Yes. And it was, you know, I mean, the Liverpool 89, Arsenal game. Now, that for me is an Arsenal game, even though Liverpool are in it, that's an Arsenal story.
Yeah.
We've done the Champions League final for Manchester United. So really big, iconic games from trying to do different clubs, yeah, really. But obviously there was more Liverpool in there because there's going to be more Liverpool fans who buy the book, obviously with my name on it.
Should we dig into Istanbul a little bit then?
Yeah.
On that note.
Let's do
it. Yeah, it was so that's the final game in the book, which presumably it always was going to be. It's just makes,
yes,
perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, it had to go in there, didn't it? I think anyone doing that book, even if it wasn't me and called the book The Greatest Games, I think Istanbul would sneak in.
Yeah.
More than sneak in.
Can you talk to us about conducting the interviews for that chapter?
Yeah, I was really interested in this.
Such
well.
An interesting dynamic for you to like rock up to see Anna Crespo or whoever and be like, all right, how are you feeling? How are you feeling? However many years ago, 16 years ago. What was that like?
It was, I mean, he wasn't initially the first one I was thinking of, but you're thinking, who can you get hold of AC Milan? And I'm just trying to, I can't remember how we hold him. Who gave me a number for? I think it was a journalist. Give me a number for him. Was it Graham Hunter or Gabriel Marcotti? Someone like that got a number for him, but he was brilliant. And I think in some ways it was interesting talking to him because he probably felt it more than anyone because he was about to be the hero for, yeah, AC Milan after his first half performance and the goals he got. You know, it was supposed to be this game for Shevchenko to win the cup again for AC Milan after that penalty he got in 2003 in the shootout at Old Trafford against Juventus. But Crespo upstages him. He's only on loan. He's still a Chelsea player. We'd knocked Chelsea out in the semi-final. And the thing I loved what he said was he had to watch Steven Gerrard lift the cup.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't quite believe it was happening. He thought it was still a dream. He, you know, they've gone in that dressing room at half-time, 3-0. He's got a couple of goals. And yeah, he was brilliant. And he was really open because, I mean, speaking about that game must be so difficult for anyone associated to AC Milan.
Mm. I think Crespo had left by the time, a couple of years later, when it was the same final with a different result, wasn't it? So I think that must make it easier for Milan that went on. It's funny, it's probably a British bias, but that one just seems like a run-of-the-mill Champions League final.
Yeah,
you don't think about
that
it the same way because it's less drama. But yeah, I mean, it's really interesting the way you talk about the tactics in the first half of that game. Where essentially, Rafa Benitez kind of switched them around a lot, back to your kind of attacking qualities. You say Alex Ferguson did the same against Barcelona in 2009 and 2011, which seems to be the case. We've seen Pep Guardiola do this all the time when he gets to like the final stages and he'll like play Edison up front or whatever. Just like completely, everything seems to go out the window. Like, that seems so common to me. It's like, do even managers turn into like daydreaming football fans when it comes to a final? Because it seems to be a really consistent thing where managers just like drop the defensive side of their team for finals. It's mad.
I think it's just managers overthinking things and almost...
How could this be? Why are they aiming off for that by this point? Everyone knows.
Has
someone not mentioned to Pep Guardiola that he overthinks stuff?
I know.
It's insane.
This game is that big. And I don't know if there's something in managers, and I think it probably is the case. The guy opposite me is obviously a top manager. The fact he's at this stage, I'm going to outthink him. I'm going to show I'm better than him. I'm going to show I'm cleverer than him. You know, and Rafa Benitez as a manager is paranoid about the opposition or the other team knowing his team.
Mm.
Paranoid about it. So he'd never give us the team. So we would never know the team until 2 hours before a game. Not because he didn't want to work on things, as he did work on things, but he would never say, right, boys, 2 days before the game, this is the 11 we're playing, this is what we want to do, and we're going to do this, because he always felt someone would tell an agent, someone would find out. So that was always a big paranoia of his, really. So I think that at times he would play teams where he'd give the team 2 hours before and you'd all be looking at each other thinking, what the fuck's this about? You know, not just that game, but, you know, different games through the league, maybe 3 or 4 times a season, you think, wow, just throw a 3 in at the back, 3 at the back in or something, you know, just from nowhere. But you, as a player, you didn't know too much about it, really. He'd work on things, but he keeps swapping players in training and keep people guessing. But when he picked that team in 2 hours before the game in Istanbul, it was a shock.
That's bizarre to think of. Because even just the fact of, maybe this is the Spurs, the Manchester United game the other week, the idea... What are you talking about? I can't remember. Anyway, the idea that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer picks a change, you know, changes his formation, and so they would only have had a little while to work on it, maybe 2 or 3 times, And so Spurs should have attacked them and because they weren't ready to play it. But it sounds like that was the case every bloody week for this Rafa Benitez side.
Yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't say we changed every week. We always have played like a 4-2-3-1.
Sure, sorry, I'm exaggerating.
No, you're right. But we wouldn't necessarily know who was going to be in those positions. Now, I mean, 7 or 8 players always play every week when they're fit, you know, for any team. There's always 3 or 4 positions that are up for grabs. But in terms of what we did on that day, Harry Kewell came from nowhere to play. So we didn't play a completely different system. But Didier Mann not playing, Harry Kewell, that was like the big one where it was like, wow. And that was almost, even though we were shocked, Rafa would be thinking, well, okay, they may be a little bit surprised, but imagine how surprised they're going to be. You know, almost that type
happy
of...
happy surprise, yeah, though, as it turned out, unfortunately. Yeah. And then Herman comes on and that changes things.
It's actually, it's nice to get a reminder of what a good player Didi Herman was, actually. There's a few there's a few moments of love for people that maybe deserve it a bit more in the book. Steve McManaman is another one. Brilliant player. Yeah. We all know he's a brilliant player, but I still don't think it's said enough. George Graham as well, which might be my own Arsenal bias. But I'm getting slightly off topic there, but like with Istanbul, it's better to have won it the way you won it, right? Oh, it must have been so stressful by halftime, but I can't even imagine what that must have been like at full time. Like, it's just, we've never seen anything like it.
I mean... what you got to remember on a football pitch is, yeah, you're playing, you're in the game, but you never have a moment to actually stop and talk to each other and think, what the fuck's going on here? You know, we've only ever been together as a whole group at half time and then back in the dressing room at full time when you're actually sat in there and you look at each other. So you can imagine what you're going through at half time, everyone look at each other, head and hands. And then probably about an hour later, hour and a half later, after all the celebrating, also you sit back down and you think, we were in here a couple of hours ago.
Yeah.
How has this happened? It's just like a freak. It was a freak. It's just, you know, 6 minutes of madness. And if you take those 6 minutes out, as I say in the book, the 120 minutes of football that we played for 114 of them, AC Milan give one of the best performances you'll ever see in a Champions League final. And that's what makes it mad.
Yeah.
You know, people have this idea that, again, we mentioned this in the book, half time, Rafa changed things. We come flying out the blocks and we got these 3 goals. And it actually walks it back until we scored the first one. We're getting battered again.
Yeah.
By AC Milan. They look like scoring another couple of goals. And then, you know, Stevie gets the header and off we go.
From a psychology perspective, what I found really interesting is what you say about half time and about coming out at half time, which is that, no, you didn't really think you were going to do it.
Yeah.
No.
You were fucking 3-0 down.
What's interesting to me on that, though, right, is because the narrative...
idea of giving up, or not giving up, obviously, but you know what I mean? Like,
And this is the narrative thing again, right, because it's younger listeners may not be able to understand this, but like Liverpool were not the sort of team that got into Champions League finals at the time. There was a romance about it. It was almost like a retro thing. It's like, fucking hell, Liverpool are like doing their 80s thing. This is really, really great. And I remember watching the game, and at halftime, me and a mate of mine were absolutely shell-shocked. And obviously we're football nerds, so we love this Milan side as well. But it's like, oh, but this is such a shame because Liverpool were doing so well. Yeah. And then a friend of mine texted me, and he's a Spurs fan. Neither of us got a dog in the fight. And he just said, Liverpool are still going to win. And I remember that so clearly. There was a sense that you were going to turn it around. Like, I think
it wasn't
people watching the game...
Yeah.
See, that's what I remember. And that's it was like the sheer strength of will made you guys win, but it's so interesting that we've just added that to it afterwards.
We've created it.
Yeah.
I think the half time is something that gets spoken about more than the game.
Yeah.
Really. What happened? What changed? And you speak about what happened, and it's almost one of those games that I love listening to what you've just said there, your story. It feels like everybody's got a story about that game, how they watched it, where they went. And it was funny because England. There was no tournament that season. So England had gone away on a tour to, I think, America, play some games. And a lot of the players obviously watched the first half because of the time difference. I think it must have been in the day. I think Peter Crouch is one. At half time, they go shopping. Some of them go out and so this game's finished.
Wow.
And then they're getting phone calls, get back, this game's still happening. It's 3-3. Peter Crouch told me that story as well. So it was, that's what I love. Everybody, whether it's, you know, any football fan, because it's the Champions League final, everybody watches the Champions League final, so it's not just a Liverpool thing, but no, it's the half time was a bit crazy with because we'd already made a substitution in the first half. Rafa Benitez made another one at half time, so Didi Mann come on, and we went to 3 at the back, and that was the change that made a big difference. Didi coming on looking after Kaká, who was unbelievable in that first half. Us going to three at the back, because as a back four, also certainly two centre backs, we couldn't cope with Crespo and Shevchenko. And it was almost like going back to school in some ways, in that we didn't think too much in that second half, even though we set up differently. It was a bit like once the first goal went in, it was like that 6 minutes was like, you know, everyone's just running everywhere and everyone's just doing mad things and I'm running forward with the ball and there's all commotion going on. It's you start playing with your heart and not your head. And then when it goes to 3-3, it's like, oh, we've got something to lose now. Mm. And then it's almost the head gets switched back on. And then AC Milan batter us for the next hour. And we're hanging on for dear life.
You've massively cut to the heart of something about being a football fan, I think, there, Jamie, about the sense that people, I think, want to mythologize what you were up to in at half time into, I guess, a way that you can understand as just like the person on the sofa or the person thinking about it. You know, you sort of want it to be like a, you know, like that the Inches speech in Any Given Sunday, or that sort of
that's moment.
Then you can all get behind it and have some sense of understanding.
I would love to go back to the half time, because sometimes when I speak of what I remember, I sometimes think, was it true? You know when you think of things a little bit and then someone else will say something else. Like Jibril Cisse said something that was just, I know, never happened for a fact. He made the story up about Stevie Gerrard sending Rafa Benitez outside and Stevie giving a speech. And I'm reading this thinking, I mean, what? So I don't know if mine's got a little bit of nonsense in it as well, but we come in and Rafa Benitez, you've got to remember, English wasn't fantastic. He comes in and right throughout that season, he was very blunt, but I think it was because he didn't have the language. If he wanted to make a change at halftime, he'd just say the person's surname and he'd just say shower. So he just come in, everyone sat down, Traore, shower. That was it. But then Steve Finnan had gone in to see the physio in a little room, and the physio came out and said he can't continue, but Steve Finnan thought he could. But I think what the physio was saying is, well, he can continue, but he won't last the game. So there was a little bit of a problem there. So next thing, Finnan's in the shower, Traore's out. We change the three at the back. And Rafa actually has 12 men on a board when he's talking about what we're going to do, because Jibril Cisse was sat there with his kit off. I don't know who with his subs tracksuit off. He was in a kit. So I don't know if Rafa's doing these names and writing names on the board, and he's seen Jibril in a full kit and written his name on this board. So we actually, when Rafa's saying what system we're doing, we've ended up having 12 men on it.
Did that make you feel confident?
With 12 men, we might have had a chance. We might have won it. But no, it wasn't how maybe people imagine, because Rafa Benitez is not a guy for a big speech. That's his thing, is changing to three at the back. What's the problem? Let's fix this. That's what makes him a special manager. He's not a motivator as such. He's not going to give a Churchillian speech at halftime, or you're talking about Any Given Sunday, the famous film, where that's used. I think actual football sport teams now use that themselves as motivation at times in team meetings. But no, he wasn't that type of guy. So it wasn't what maybe people expect, or people say, what were you saying? Or what was Stevie saying? Like we're all arguing or fighting and screaming and shouting at each other. It wasn't like that at all. It was very despondent when we first went in, because it was, you know, the biggest game of your life. And you're not just getting beat, you're getting embarrassed. You know, so it was hard to sort of start pointing the finger at other people when we were playing so poorly ourselves.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, mate.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Funny, isn't it? Like 89, 90, a lot happened. And the 96 as well, when you look at the Liverpool 4-3 against Newcastle, and obviously that whole story of Keegan. So many amazing football stories are from that season. And then you had Euro 96 at the end of it as well. Yeah. And actually the bits in the book about Euro 96 and that and the 5-1 over Germany in Munich are really interesting as well, because the tone is a little bit different from how you might expect, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be great to hear a bit more about these. I mean, we got the impression, I think, that, or in fact, you say it overtly, you know, you playing for England was not the greatest pinnacle of your career, right? It was it was all about club football, and particularly in that era. It'd be interesting to get your thoughts on how things are now. But looking at those games, the way they were organised back to front in terms of time sequence, you were effectively saying the England team went backwards.
Yes. Yeah, that was a deliberate thing in terms of where we put the chapters in the book. I do feel, when you think of not just England, but foreign managers I've had, it's really interesting, because a lot of the foreign managers I had were 4-4-2 men, were strong on discipline, clean sheet. So that's Gerard Houllier, Rafa Benitez, Sven-Goran Eriksson, Fabio Capello. And the British managers I've had, in terms of Roy Evans, Brendan Rodgers, Kenny Dalglish, they wanted to play more football than those type of managers. So, and you actually go back to sort of 96, and you go into what Glenn Hoddle was trying to do and Terry Venables. It almost looks like football now. And, you know, you're not quite sure what system Venables is going to play. He's going to play three at the back, but he's not going to have wing backs. He's going to have wingers in those positions. A very, you could imagine Pep Guardiola doing it. And I do feel that we did go backwards there. I think it was a real shame that we lost Venables at that time. Obviously Hoddle for different reasons, but you know, we don't need to just go abroad. We have got great thinkers in this country, and those at that time were certainly two of the best. And when you watch those games and look at the systems, and, you know, the role of sometimes of Gareth Southgate in one of the games, I think he was playing holding midfield, and his job was to drop back into the back four when, you know, something like the Dutch would do. Mm. You know, so I think he was really not just ahead of his time. Terry Venables was just a brilliant coach of that England team. But we went through those games, and you know, these are two of the most probably famous games outside of a tournament. You
so
know,
yeah, just to, for, I mean, everyone's obviously going to buy the book and read it immediately, but just in case they're not listening.
You already have, haven't they?
Yes, I'm sure. You're right. It is a book club. Just so that everyone knows which ones we're talking about. We're talking about the 2001 FIFA World Cup qualifier. So it's the England game where we famously beat Germany 5-1. And then after that, in the book, you talk about the 1996 England 4-1 win against Holland.
Yeah, and analysing them, really, I mean, England do not play anywhere near as well as people believe when you look at the score lines. I mean, The 5-1 game in Germany, England were really poor. I'm on the bench, were really poor in the first half and should be losing the game. And then, obviously, because we're in, I think Germany got a bit more emotional and we hit them on the counter-attack through Michael and Emil Heskey in the second half. But in the first half, we're all over the place, really continually giving the ball away. Sebastian Deisler, I think it was, is causing us huge problems between the lines. They're making passes. Didi Amand running the game, firing balls, as I said, between our lines in terms of the 4-4-2 that we always played under Sven. And before you know it, you're in 5-1. But if you actually watch the game back, you could almost see why, when you go to the tournament, Germany get to the final and we don't do anything. You know, even though we've battered them, they didn't have great players at the time, Germany. In that first half, you can see actually the patterns and what they're trying to do, whereas we're just continually giving the ball away. And we're great players, don't get me wrong, in the book, it's probably Stevie and Scholes, and they're always looking for this 50, 60-yard pass over the top for Michael Owen. And that was almost the way that team was set up in some ways, you know, playing to his strengths. But when it comes off, it's great, as it did in the second half. But in the first half, you're thinking, if you play like that in a World Cup in heat, you're going to have a big problem. And that was the analysis of that game. But the Dutch game as well, that was interesting watching that back, because I didn't really... Number one, what I would say is, when you think of the Dutch and you go through the team, when you actually look at the team on paper, there's a few players you don't really know. Because in your head, you're thinking, this must be the Ajax team that won the Champions League in 95 or got to the Champions League final in 96. And when you look at the team, I'm not trying to knock the England players any one bit, but it's not what you'd expect on the pitch from the Dutch, to be fair. And there's also a really big chance, I think at 0-0, I think it's Beerkamp goes through, and or at 1-0, and I think has a huge bearing. But don't get me wrong, there's a spell in the second half where the goals come, where it's just like, I think a lot of it's direct, actually, when I think back of it now. I think a lot of it is a ball up to Schengen, he flicks it on to Shearer, and a couple of goals like that. Listen, there's no right or wrong way you can, but I think the way it's thought of now is that we out-Dutch the Dutch, if you like, and totally. I don't think that's quite what happened.
No, yeah, watching it back, that's the impression I get as well, even just from the goals. Like, they are direct. It's responding to another team collapsing rather than, like, forcing them to collapse.
So we've got to ask him about Sven. One of our guys on the Ramble is, like, obsessed with Sven Göran Eriksson.
In a good way or a bad way?
In
both ways.
In a slightly odd way.
In a 360-degree way.
But he, for you, wasn't... How would you describe the your thoughts about his management?
There was a mystique about Sven because he was the first foreign manager and he was different to other managers, that no one really spoke to him too much, and he was standoffish. And we got great results when he came in. So it was almost like, wow, Sven, Chelsea wanted him, Man United wanted him, everyone wanted him. There was like this spell he had over English football. But when you actually look back here, I think, well, what did that take from Sven really tactically in the game, in the training session? Not a lot, I would say. I was working, don't get, at that time with Gerard Houllier and Rafa Benitez. They were much bigger influencers, as you would expect. I'm working with them every day.
And you were excited about talking to him, weren't you? Because you love to talk about football, and you were like, yeah, I'm going to learn stuff. We're going to have conversations. And that's not how it worked out.
Yeah, I mean, Sven's big, I think, learning really as a young coach was Liverpool in those early 80s. I think he came to Melbourne to watch them. He's a big 4-4-2 man. I think he was one of the first guys in Sweden to abolish the sweeper system and go with a 4-4-2. So he was a revolutionary in his own country, and that's where his success come from. And also, this is not me trying to knock him, because I'm well aware of the things he achieved in Italy. You know, getting to a European Cup final with Benfica, you know, against that AC Milan team in 1990 against Sacchi. I think he, if I remember, he went into that game and he lost his two left-backs before the game. So you can imagine how tough that must have been playing against that team. So wasn't it a great thing for him? He goes to Sampdoria. So he's managed at an unbelievably high level with top players. I just think, oh, give me a bit of information, give me a little bit more. But his thing was about sort of being cool, calm, not getting too emotional as an England manager, really. But I do think we underachieved, because I think we had great players. I do think we had great players at that time.
And sometimes you've got to drop some of your great players in order to
actually have a
football team.
Yeah,
exactly. And I mean, thinking about the... Because this was published last year, wasn't it? So thinking about the Euros, is it a shame that you didn't have one of those to include in the book? Or would none of those games have made it?
You know what? You've just given me an idea.
Greatest Games Part 2?
Worst
Games.
The paperback. And you said to me earlier, I don't think I actually answered it, you said that it was the game we wanted to put in that we didn't do. Now, I think, if I'm rightly, I think all of those games have got an English team or an English team plus a foreign team. I wanted to do something on the famous AC Milan of Sacchi, and maybe not even Sacchi, might have been the Barcelona game in 94 with Capello, but I just thought how difficult it would be trying to get hold of people to talk about. You're talking about two foreign teams. But I think what would be really interesting to analyse would be the England, the final against Italy, because that could be the paperback's out. You might bring a second paperback out, because
it's like a bonus
yeah,
content.
We might have a bonus one looking back at it, because there was a lot of criticism for Gareth Southgate, and everyone always says in football, why didn't we have a go second half? But sometimes as a manager, a game is going on and it's difficult to change. Right, Italy put us under pressure. What does Gareth Southgate shout on? Lads, have a go with them. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah.
You know.
How useful. Thank you, Gareth.
Yeah. Now, we don't have amazing central midfield players in terms of technically to run a game. And also, I keep thinking back, and I still argue this. If you're an England manager thinking before that game, you want to take the lead. And the reason you want to take the lead in that game is because you want Chiellini and Bonucci on the halfway line. That's where you want them. Mm. That's exactly where you want them. And that's where England had them, really. Now, you're watching the game thinking, oh, Italy. There was this feeling watching, wasn't Italy going to score shortly? You can feel it coming. And I get that. And could Gareth change some or made a tactical change? But I don't think any change then was all of a sudden going to shift Italy back to the edge of their box and England were going to be halfway lane dictating play.
Yeah,
Italy were always going to push on because of the situation they were in. But I had Dominic Calvert-Lewin on Monday Night Football, and I mentioned this, and I know he couldn't say it, but I'd been quite critical of Harry Kane right throughout the tournament. I thought he didn't look anywhere near his best, or he looked sluggish. He's taken that into this season. I love him as a player. I think he's amazing, great player. But that was the change he had to make after 10 minutes, 15 minutes of that second half, and he didn't want to bring Kane off. Even though he'd been brave enough to bring him off through the tournament, maybe he was thinking of penalties or... Do you bring your captain off if he's supposed to lift the truck? I don't know. But we didn't have anyone with pace against the centre-backs. I think he brought Saka on. And if you remember, there was one where Chiellini pulled him back. But that was in a wide area. I just thought if someone, Calvert-Lewin, just make him runs in behind. Because every time Harry Kane went short for the ball, that was just playing into Bonucci and Chiellini's hand. And every time the ball went short, they just went bang. Took the ball off them and they were back on us.
Shit, it's almost to you. Obviously, this is breaking it down to massive basics, but if Harry Kane had been a bit more on form, that could have been the difference.
I don't think it was so much on form. I just think Harry Kane has become a player now where he has to come to feet because he can't run in behind. So I don't think he could have ran in behind as such, if you understand what I mean. So his game is now coming short for the ball. Holding the ball, and I just think that was playing into their hands. They were aggressive, they were getting in front of him, they were winning the ball, and every time England cleared it, now don't get me wrong, a lot of the passes into them were not great, and a lot of them were clearances, not passes. I'm well aware of that, and sometimes that can happen through nerves. What's happening? No one wants to make that pass that gets cut out and you can see the goal, so that comes into the game as well. So, you know, I don't like it always being put on the manager. Sometimes something's happening and you've got to make the best of it. As I said before, right, we need to make sure we keep a clean sheet. How can we keep a clean sheet and we win the tournament? It's not about go and get the second goal, because the nerves are set in the crowd, the tension, Harry Kane's coming short, we can't get out. Mm. But I do think the one thing we could have done was tested those, certainly with pace-wise, over the top.
Also, it's the bloody Euros final, guys. Yeah. You know, this is not something you can just solve from your sitting room. For me, the sadness was I was there right on the... Where we took the penalties, I was kind of parallel with that on the ground level. And I was just absolutely convinced, obsessed with this idea that if we could get to penalties, we'd win on penalties. Mm. Just, I think possibly because I felt like we'd banished the whole thing.
I don't think we had any chance on penalties. not because of the... I just thought their keeper.
Yeah.
I thought he'd been...
But as it turned out, Pickford was the one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but he'd look so... And I watched him last night save a penalty in the... in the Champions League in Leipzig. So, and Leipzig took another penalty and they scored, actually. He got a 50% record last night, but that was just my feeling that I just looked at the size of him in that goal, not so much the penalty takers of us, because we've been successful a little bit under Southgate, but he's just a man mountain, isn't he, Donnarumma?
I thought we would have had a chance on penalties because Italy had won a penalty shootout to get there. It's quite rare to do two in a row.
I've seen these
but
stats.
But that just turned out to be and bollocks.
Had been. Yeah. No one wins two penalty shootouts in a row in the tournament. So I saw all that.
Oh, God. Sorry. It's actually still quite hard to talk about. So do you think you would then slot this one in? Because it seems like...
Give me an idea. I'll give you some mention. I'll try and give you some mention. Listen.
Because the point is as well, with Gareth Southgate specifically, it would, you know, you already have that nice arc of the two England games, and then you've got the arc of him obviously being manager. And his thing was, he said, we needed Winston Churchill, we got Ian Duncan Smith.
Yeah. Well, I actually spoke to Gareth Southgate on the phone about this book and wanted him to talk about Terry Venables and Euro 96 and his role in that. But at the time, because of the pandemic, Gareth said the FA didn't want him to speak about anything else other than stuff to do with the... Basically, they had to keep their sponsors happy because everyone was cutting money and taking money away and losing money. And it was a bit like, if the England manager's speaking, it has to be for one of our sponsors to keep them on, to keep them involved. So that was... So we did try and get Gareth.
And maybe he'll be freer now.
Yeah.
Now the pandemic is over. As you say, it's hard for people to hide from you. One thing I was really interested to ask you about, again, going back to you as a player specifically, is this idea of panic. You talk about panic in a number of these games where teams just kind of start to crumble and they get chipped away at.
And you see it as a fan, don't you?
You see it.
The tide turn in the game.
It's hard to know because you're always projecting. Like, yeah. I always try, it's so hard to try and aim off, but I always try and like control from what I want to see with what's going on the pitch. And then that's why you watch it back as well, because then you can like distract yourself from your original emotions. But in terms of the like, that sense of panic is so interesting because I think what you say is that it, in some ways it can get worse as you get more experienced because you know the outcome, the potential real negatives, whereas you'd think instinctively that it should get easier over time as you're more experienced.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you can look at it both, you know, different ways. I just think when you can't actually control what's going on a football pitch, you can almost feel it happening. And I think when you're older, you've been there before and you can feel it happening. I think that goes back to the England game. You just, even though if you think about Italy's goals from a corner, you know, a bit of luck and something happens. But it's almost like everyone was just watching that game, thinking something's going to happen. And I think sometimes you can't control it in some ways. And I always think about the AC Milan game in Istanbul, and it's almost like it had to go 3-3 for almost AC Milan to go, okay, you've got your 3-3 now. You know what I mean? Let's get back to normal. It's almost this thing's happening and you can sort of see it happening. I think we felt it as soon as we got the second one. I always say, I knew we were getting the third. I knew that was coming quickly. It was just, they probably knew it. It was almost like, all right, get your third and let's get on with the proper game. You know, that thing where you can just feel it and sense it in the ground, can't you? And feel that tension.
Yeah.
All questions, I reckon, you can continue to ask in your many chats with the great and the good of football. Jamie, we could talk to you for another 4 hours or something and it would be still fun. But
I've got to get on the 12:07.
Oh, yeah, we better get you out of here then. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. We've really, really enjoyed it. Give Jamie's podcast a listen. It's called The Greatest Game. Pick that up wherever you get your podcasts. And buy the book. It's The Greatest Games. You can get this at all good bookshops. And it's fantastic. Basically, we really enjoyed it. And as for you guys, get in touch with what you'd like us to read next. I'm on at KVL Mason. Jim?
I am at Jim Campbell TFR.
Or you can tweet us at Football Ramble, and we'll catch you next time for Book Club. Thank Brilliant. You, Jamie Carragher.
Thank you. Thanks to the Football Ramble for having me. Thank
no
you.
Worries.
Football Ramble Presents is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.